listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Facebook's stock has fallen more than 25% since the company went public on May 18th. What was hyped as the biggest technology IPO in history has quickly become a black eye for both Wall Street banks and Facebook itself. But that doesn't necessarily mean the company will move quickly to appease investors, as NPR's Steve Henn explains.
Nelly Saipalm bought $1,000 in Facebook stock on its very first day of trading.
I guess, honestly, I didn't think I would be able to buy shares that day.
She was expecting an old-school internet stock frenzy. She paid $40 a share. Today, Saipalm's lost almost a third of her original investment, but she's decided to hold on for now.
If, let's just say, it just starts going down and down and down to like the teens, then at that point, I might decide to sell.
This isn't the IPO story so many of us remember from the 1990s.
How did this happen?
Scott Kessler is an analyst at S&P IQ.
How did this IPO that seemed to be so kind of anticipated, so heralded, turn into the stock that has dramatically underperformed?
And actually, Kessler's not really baffled by this. He was one of the first analysts on Wall Street to recommend against buying shares in Facebook. Kessler says even today, Facebook's profits don't justify its stock price. Even after the recent plunge, he says the company's share price is still propped up by hype.
You know, I'm aware of the fact that this was and is a company where there's tremendous interest, and that interest can generally lead to interesting things happening. Let's just say that.
Its stock price, even now, is only justifiable if you assume Facebook is going to go on to do great and enormously profitable things, like change advertising as we know it. Carlos Kushner is an internet analyst at Sanford Bernstein. He says while this is possible,
we think that all this potential is tremendously uncertain.
In other words, investing in Facebook is not a sure thing. It never was. Instead, for an investor who went in with their eyes open, Facebook was always a speculative, long-term bet. And it's largely a gamble on one man, Mark Zuckerberg. Even though the company has sold shares to the public, Facebook's co-founder and CEO retains nearly absolute control. He owns a majority of the voting stock. He can't easily be fired. The board of directors cannot really overturn his decisions. A shareholder revolt will never push him out. So while many companies in a similar spot might be scrambling to boost profits and placate investors, it's unclear if Facebook has to respond at all.
I think that's a good and really important question, and I don't know the answer.
Scott Kessler.
Facebook's priority is its users, is user engagement, and is the user experience. They're not particularly interested in or focused on short-term financial results.
And while that might be good news for the more than 900 million people who don't want their Facebook page cluttered with new intrusive ads, it could also mean that Facebook's most recent investors will have to wait a long time before they see any return on their money. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
People have been buzzing for weeks in anticipation of a new mystery novel by Gillian Flynn. It's called Gone Girl, and it's out today. NPR's Linda Wertheimer spoke with Flynn about a book in which the characters not only lie to each other, but also to the reader.
The book begins with a young husband talking about his wife. "When I think of my wife, I always think of her head," he says. And then he goes on, "You could imagine the skull quite easily. I'd know her head anywhere." A sort of faintly sinister sound to that. This is the morning of their fifth anniversary, and it is the day that Nick Dunn's wife, Amy, disappears. That's the event this novel turns on, twists on, might be better, because the police think he might have murdered her. The two parties to this marriage of 5 years tell their story in alternating chapters. At the beginning of the book, he's in the present. She's represented by a journal. Gone Girl is Gillian Flynn's third novel. She joined us from our New York bureau. Miss Flynn, there's an extraordinary description of their courtship in the book. I wonder if you could read that part for us.
Certainly. That night at the Brooklyn party, I was playing the girl who was in style, the girl a man like Nick wants, the cool girl. Men always say that as the defining compliment, don't they? She's a cool girl. Being the cool girl means I'm a hot, brilliant, funny woman who adores football, poker, dirty jokes, and burping, who plays video games and drinks cheap beer.
So their relationship begins with her deception that she is the cool girl.
Yeah, you know, I was definitely playing with the idea of how difficult it is in this day and age to have an authentic self. We're under this barrage of pop culture, you know, TV, movies, the internet. We become sort of creatures that we've made up. I mean, you made up certain different flotsam from pop culture and certain different personas that are in style. And it was definitely playing with that idea of what do you do when you two people marry, they each have a certain persona that they have created, and as that gets dismantled, what does that reveal?
You make the faltering economy a major backdrop of the story. These two young people move back to Missouri after they both lose great jobs in New York City and have to leave their beautiful Brooklyn brownstone. Their own changed circumstances add huge changes to the marriage. So the economy is a character.
The economy is very much present. I started writing the book as the economy was faltering. And I myself was one of those former journalists who lost their job in the big wave of layoffs that happened throughout the media at the time. And so I wanted them both to be writers and to have lost that means of support and to be forced to these reduced circumstances. And what happens when you lose that outlet and you lose that self-identifier?
I wonder if you think that if times had been prosperous, if they'd been hanging out in that brownstone forever, they would have been okay or at least different?
I don't think this couple ever would have been okay. Sooner or later, they would have uncovered the third or fourth layer of who they really were and found out that they were a very toxic combination for each other. But certainly, I wanted them to feel that they were slowly being put in smaller and smaller boxes and what that pressure does to a couple when the different layers that they're proud of are taken away from them until, you know, they're back on the banks of the Mississippi River in Missouri, just the two of them in a house.
One of the other not human characters in the book is the media, because when Amy disappears, all of a sudden there's a tremendous interest all over the country in what happened to her. Did he do her in?
Absolutely. It's something I've always been kind of fascinated by, which is our increasing interest in true crime. I mean, we've always been kind of fascinated by it. But the idea of the media descending on this tragedy is very fascinating to me. You know, we're in an era in which tragedy is almost packaged as sort of consumable tragedy. And you always know the different ingredients that are going to go into it, the beautiful wife who's perfect and the husband who probably did it. And certainly Nick suffers from that immediately, is because everyone knows to look at the husband first. And he's a guy who looks like a beautiful, handsome, you know, 80s villain. He's got the blonde hair and the snarky good looks. So he's immediately becomes a victim of that in a way.
Even when we talk about Amy disappears, Nick is suspected of having had a hand in her disappearance and all, that's really not the scariest part of this thing. The scariest part of the book is marriage.
To me, marriage is the ultimate mystery. And, you know, there's that phrase, no one knows what goes on in anyone's marriage. And I guess the bottom line of this book is no one knows what's going on in your own marriage a little bit, because we can't entirely know each other. And I think that's why married couples, when they're telling the story at dinner and one of them's getting it wrong, get so intense and crazy about it. You know, you're telling the story wrong. It's because it's frightening to think, well, we were both at this exact same experience and he's getting or she's getting it wrong. What else do we have complete disconnects on? And there's something very frightening about that at its core.
You know, I was sort of amused to see that in the section of the book where authors thank everybody who helped them, you have this lovely hymn of praise to your husband, almost as if, okay, guys, don't think that this is us. It's not us.
It is so far from us, although there are certain lines every once in a while that he would read and say, wait, you stole that from me. That sounds like an argument we had, or that sounds like a debate that we have. But it's a tough thing to go to your spouse and say, I'm going to write an incredibly dark story about marriage. Is that cool with you? He was very gracious about the whole thing, and I told him, once you read through it, if there's anything that feels like it's cutting too close to the bone, let me know. And he was game all the way, so I'm very grateful for that.
Gillian Flynn, her third book is called Gone Girl. She spoke to us from our New York bureau. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
NPR's Linda Wertheimer talking with novelist Gillian Flynn about her new book, Gone Girl.
Come along on our custom-designed trip to England and Wales this September. Experience the real Downton Abbey in a private tour just for friends of WILL. See lovely Cotswold villages, the Yorkshire countryside, and meet Alan J. W. Bell, producer of Last of the Summer Wine. Tour Greenway, Agatha Christie's home, the English spa town of Bath, and visit the Jane Austen Centre before wrapping up the trip in London. Our tour is almost full, so call 217-333-7300 for more information.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 5th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of the novelist Margaret Drabble, born Sheffield, England, 1939, author of 17 novels. Most recent one was The Sea Lady. Last year, a collection of her short stories, A Day in the Life of a Smiling Woman. Margaret Drabble, who wrote in her novel A Natural Curiosity, one character says, "England's not a bad country. It's just a mean, cold, ugly, divided, tired, clapped-out post-imperial, post-industrial slag heap covered in polystyrene hamburger cartons. It's not a bad country at all. I love it." It's the birthday of the novelist Rick Riordan, born in San Antonio, 1964, the child of teachers. He was a teacher himself, interested in Greek and Norse mythology. He told his sons Greek myths as bedtime stories. He set out to write a book about a young demigod in contemporary America, a half-human son of the god Poseidon, a boy who has ADHD and dyslexia, learns his true parentage, goes on a quest to retrieve Zeus's lightning bolt. He first told it to his son, who told him he should make it into a book, and it became The Lightning Thief, the first book in the popular five-volume Percy Jackson and the Olympians series for young adults. It's the birthday of the poet Federico Garcia Lorca, born in Fuente Vaqueros near Granada, Spain, 1898. His most famous book of poems, Gypsy Ballads, came out in 1928. It's the birthday of Bill Moyers, born Hugo, Oklahoma, 1934. Known for his public affairs programs on television, his interview series including The Power of Myth and A World of Ideas, and Moyers and Company. And it was on this date in 1851, Uncle Tom's Cabin began its serial run in abolitionist newspaper, The National.